Now it brings me great pleasure to introduce our first speaker in the Ecovention series. Author and eco-instigator Fritz Haig studied architecture in Italy and Carnegie Mellon University, where he received his bachelor's in architecture. He is author of several books, including Edible Estates, Attack on the Front Lawn, which there should be copies still available in the lobby for sale after Fritz Haig's talk. His work has been featured in by BBC, NPR, ABC, CBS, and The Martha Stewart Show. He has appeared in dozens of publications, including Metropolitan Home, The New Yorker, Time Magazine, Art Forum, Dwell, and The Washington Post. The New York Times describes his work as genre-defying and a brilliant synthesis of refined design principles, optimistic spectacle, and homegrown activism. He has had numerous shows, including at London's Tate Museum, the Whitney in New York, San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, and the Netherlands Architecture Institute. He has taught architecture, design, and fine art at a variety of institutions, including the University of Southern California. For years, his home has served as a gathering place for an extended community galvanized through events, performances, and spectacles. Tonight, he will be talking about his Edible Estates and Animal Estates projects. Please help me welcome Fritz Haig.
Thanks so much, Frederica. Sorry for the late start, everyone. I hope everyone's comfortable. Mostly I'm going to talk about one project that I've been working on for the last 4 years or so, the Edible Estates Project. And if I have time, I'll talk a little bit about some animals. But I wanted to start with this image here, which is my compost pile. And to me, this is, anyone who's a gardener knows that the compost pile is like the engine of the garden. And it's also exactly the sort of thing that we have the tendency to want to hide. As a matter of fact, whenever I'm planning a garden, I'm always strongly encouraging people to not hide the compost pile in the backyard, but instead to put it at the front stoop, where it's the first thing that people see when they come to your house, and you welcome them and you show them your compost pile, and it's there for everyone to see. And I think we will have evolved to our full potential as human beings when we recognize how beautiful a compost pile is. And when you think of it, there is nothing more phenomenal that we do than to have one of these in our property. Here is played before us like the most gorgeous principle that exists, this thing that all the junk and stuff that we give the value zero to that accumulates in our trash or at the bottom of the forest or the garden goes into this magic chamber and not only gets repurposed or reused or recycled, as we kind of are wanting to do now as humans, but it goes to the top. So it becomes the most fertile possible material on your property. So just that idea that the trash can become the future life of, and not only like, oh, it's a nice thing to do, it's like, no, if this doesn't happen, we're all screwed and nothing happens, you know? I mean, this is constantly happening at the bottom of any natural environment. Composting happens naturally in the forest floor, of course. Here we're doing it in a, you know, accelerated way, but it is the most vital system that exists. And here it is like happening in our property. And here it is like the best possible model of how we could be functioning as humans. And I'm interested in composting as a pragmatic functional thing at home with my kitchen scraps. I'm interested in it as a metaphor for how we could function across all layers of our society. But I'm also interested in placing it publicly in front of our homes as a reminder, like evidence. Like, when you see this, you recognize the fact that, yes, this happens. And sometimes that's all we need, is that reminder. And a lot of the projects that I'm doing are all about evidence, all about providing evidence for things that have been rendered invisible because of our desire in the 20th century to hide all evidence of our survival in our urban bubbles. So this compost pile, the Guardian newspaper invited me to write a little op-ed piece about the new White House Obama garden. And I spent some time thinking about that and writing about it. And in the press release, I was really intrigued by a short paragraph on the new White House compost pile. And I thought, like, how amazing. We have a White House compost pile that's our national compost pile. We need to see pictures of it. We need to know where it is, what's going in there, what's coming out. I think it should be placed, maybe there should even be two, like, to be symmetrical, on either side of the ceremonial south portico entry of the White House where visiting dignitaries come. And when they arrive, Barack shows off like the coffee grounds from that morning's coffee, and you know, this is what we had for breakfast, and this is where what we're gonna eat from is gonna come from this. Like, this is important. It's important symbolically, and it's important functionally. So having moved to LA 10 years ago from New York and grown up in the Midwest, I'm very aware of this Pacific edge, and I think we're all kind of aware of the tendency of people living on the West Coast of the United States to be thinking more about how we're living. And I think a lot of that comes out of this daily awareness of limits. Because as a country that was occupied and claimed from east to west, we had this sense of occupation that started with, like this painting by Albert Bierstadt, infinite resources, infinite possibilities. This idea of this land that was ours and we owned it, manifest destiny, and that it was limitless. And for us that live on this edge, we know that we've hit the wall and there's a limit, and it actually isn't infinite at all. And here's an example of these wonderful paintings that were sent back, this one by Albert Bierstadt, like I said, that showed this very idealized version of what this landscape looked like to people out east. And here is a picture from that same location. There's a wonderful book called Tending the Wild by Kat Anderson that is a wonderful kind of scholarly research piece, I think she spent over a decade on it, about the native people who lived just north of LA in the Tejon Ranch area and how they occupied the land there. And you can see here's what Europeans were seeing when they were coming, and here's what's happening. And she talks in detail about how this landscape that appeared to be wild was not wild. This was one vast garden that was being tended by a very low density population that was strategically harvesting, setting fires, straightening cane to weave baskets. There was a great deal of human intervention happening there, but it wasn't apparent. This is pre-agriculture, this is pre-gardens as we know it today, where you would draw a line and say, this is mine, wild, man-made, you know? Like, a lot of the root words of garden in different languages come from the root word of walled enclosure of some sort. This idea of a garden being something that is protected from wilderness, that humans are separate from nature, and we're having to define the limits of that. But here, European mindset doesn't understand a landscape like this, that's a garden landscape, that's a tended landscape. And all of my work, I'm really interested in bringing back, not this idealized fantasy of returning to a life like this, but this idea where our cities could be once again confused with nature in such a way that they would overlap and bridge each other so that you couldn't separate them anymore. So here the European settlers arrive and say, oh, look at these lazy natives living high off this gorgeous Eden, when in fact that's not what's happening at all. This is a lot of work living here, and they're actively tending all of this. And here's what we're seeing in the UK, these English estates. And this is what where we've really kind of appropriated our idea from the American dream from this kind of situation. Here we have the kind of opposite situation where we have this huge house surrounded by a lawn, and this is really the first evidence of lawn used to this degree in the way that I'll be looking at it later as we see today across the United States. This lawn that demonstrates wealth, that says, I'm so rich, I can take this valuable farmland, and I'm not even gonna grow food there. That's how rich I am. Plus, how dramatic my house looks when the landscape is repressed and the house becomes dominant. It's all about domination. And it's very clear who's in charge here. And also what's beginning to happen here, which is a real break with tradition, is that the growth of food, which had previously been very much intertwined with aesthetic, beautiful gardens, French kitchen gardens, monastic gardens, here has been hidden from view. So where is the food? It's hidden out back. And it's the beginning of this idea that plants that produce food are ugly and not meant to be seen, and that sterile monoculture is beautiful. And this is a real shift in our ideas about aesthetics and what's acceptable in the landscape. And these ideas, these really antiquated ideas about beauty and appropriateness in the landscape, are hundreds of years old, and we're continuing them out of sheer habit. They're beginning to shift out of just sheer need and soon crisis, perhaps, but I'm interested in shifting them not because we have to, but because we want to, because there's things that are like so much more fun than this, I think. And plus, like our ideas of the English estate today, which we've all appropriated, are now these minuscule things that I'll show you. So here we have one of the first great models of what our American dream would be. Each American with their own isolated home surrounded by a lawn. Now, what's amazing about this is Thomas Jefferson was a phenomenal gardener. He was obsessed with his garden. But where is Thomas Jefferson's garden that he loved so much? It's down the hill behind a row of trees in a grid. So how peculiar that someone who loved it so much would have treated it in such a way. And I think of this as the beginning of global industrial agriculture, hidden from view, laid out in grids and lines and rows pragmatically, like, that is not pleasure, that is production. And what is pleasure? What is in front of the house? The lawn and these kind of curvy beds of annual flowers or whatever. And also these ideas that curvy lines are fun and pleasurable and the straight lines are about getting the job done. And those continue with us today in different ways. And then we fast forward a bit to the Victory Garden movement during the wars here. And here we have the last period in this country where this oral tradition of growing food where we live happens. Now, during the wars, people were growing food by a call from the government because a lot of farmers were away at war, and there was a real need to for people to grow their own food. This was not because people wanted to grow food or because it was a, you know, like today, there's a lot of people doing it because it provides a real pleasure and escape from the overly mediated experiences that we have in the rest of our lives. At that time, it was like crisis, like we're screwed, the farmers are gone, we need to eat, we have to grow our own food. Up to 80% of Americans were growing some amount of their own food in places in our cities today that would be really surprising to us, like in LA, in these apartment complexes. So if you think about it, 80% of Americans growing some amount of their own food is pretty amazing, like up until the early 40s. And then as soon as the war ended, that just dried up right away. And we have the 50s and the introduction of convenience. And this idea that all these new technological introductions that were going to save us time and make everything really convenient for us. So here, this oral tradition really dries up about how to grow food where we live. And if anyone here has tried to grow food, you know that it's a highly localized activity. You can spend your whole life getting to know the particularities of growing food in a particular place and then move somewhere else and be clueless for a few seasons or a few years until you talk to everyone else around you who's been growing food there for a while. As a side note, we were doing workshops in Austin where I was doing one of the gardens, weekly workshops on growing food, and the master gardener woman who gave us the talk on growing food in Austin, which is super hard, super challenging, told the most moving story. I mean, she was kind of a, you know, it's a kind of a dry conversation about okay, let's grow food in Austin. But she started out with this really moving talk about where she learned how to grow food in Austin. And it was from this elderly couple she met when she moved to Austin. They were in their 80s. They taught her everything they knew about growing food in that climate. And they're gone, they died. And she's carrying with her 70 years of their firsthand gardening experiences in that place. So I have no illusions about knowing how to garden or grow food in any of the places that I go in the face of that kind of intelligence that grows with time. And I think it's important to pay attention to that. Wonderful propaganda posters. So what we have in the 50s is this explosion of home ownership. We have the leisure weekend. We have the chemical companies turning their attention away from inventions for war to pesticides for plants and crops. And we have the creation of communities and suburbs that were largely presaged or at least influenced by Le Corbusier, the great architect of the 20th century, who wrote this kind of phenomenal sentence about the radiant cities that he was designing, which when we read them today, it's kind of horrifying to understand that this was all planned and actually that thought it was a good idea, if you read this. And you read this today and you think it's gonna it's gonna end in kind of this dark place, but instead it ends with a very excited like exclamation mark, like we're on our way, how exciting. And it's amazing because it really presaged the kind of world that we're living in now. This idea that you could make the cities part of the country and have neither lose anything in that exchange. Here's the city of Lakewood being built in the 40s, a city of about 70,000 built in 3 or 4 years, where I did the second of the gardens that I'll show you. And here's the situation that I'm really interested in. Is this how we're living today because it's what people want or because it's what people are given? And I don't even think we know anymore, but it's what we have. And I'm not interested in utopian proposals of starting over. I think much of the great minds of the 20th century architect were wasted on saying, oops, that didn't work, let's start over. And I don't think that's a terribly productive way to be thinking today. I'm much more interested in taking stock of everything that we've had, everything that we've made, and thinking in small ways of how each one of us individually can enter into it consciously, question it, and then participate in it. And I'm not handing down my diatribe or manifesto of what we have to do. My work is more about an invitation to people to awaken to the possibilities of the places that already exist around them. So the garden project that I'm going to be talking about is specifically located here between the front door of the house and the street. The strategic moment where this vacancy of the lawn is happening now and where something else I'm saying could happen. Now what we see here is evidence of isolation. And this isolation that exists is engineered into our homes, into our cities, into our global culture. Isolation is engineered at every level now, which was primarily for convenience, I suppose. In zoning, it was important to keep heavy industry away from where people lived. Today, those things are less important. And if we look at the isolation happening here, it's happening from house to house. It's happening from all these houses to where these people live or work or play. And then it's happening from where these people are eating, from where their food is coming from. So here is a situation that they're never going to see, participate in, or understand. This is a picture I took from a plane in the desert southwest, this remote production of food, in these most mysterious of conditions where there is no water. And you realize these circles are only there because everything outside of that circle is not getting water to be able to be green. So that gives you a great indication of how unnatural it is for this stuff to be growing there. So here's the people, here's the food. How bizarre, you know? And what a waste to think that all of that space of all these wonderful plants growing could be opened up for pleasure, and what a waste that all of this vacancy of these moats from home to home could be recharged with some sort of activity. And then isolation that happens within the house. So if you look at the history of 20th century North American shelter, you can see the slow progression from everyone sharing one room, all functions, all people. They didn't see any reason to isolate activities or people to the degree that we do today, to colonial times, and then today. So you can see this infinite fracturing where we feel like we need a separate cubicle cell for every person, every activity. And this isolation that you see depicted here in the plan happens in the suburban plan, happens in the global network of food and energy distribution. And what I'm interested in with all these projects is in very modest ways, like knitting them back together. Now, here are these amazing illustrations of the American dream. And I'm more interested in the illustrations than I am in the pictures, because the illustrations tell us what we really want, like the idealized version. And you will always see the same kind of things in these pictures. You always see wilderness. You always see wild space, trees, but it's always at a distance. It's safely at bay. It's never like in your face and scary. It's like, and it's kept at bay usually by this lawn that's always there to demarcate dominance, control from the chaos of the wilderness out there. And then you'll never see another house, because we're all living with this illusion, fantasy that we dominate, we're on our own. The greatest thing you can say about where you live is like, oh my God, I can't see another house from where you live. Like, how great, how cool. That's awesome. You know, this fantasy, especially the farther west that you go, that fantasy that we have. And it's something that's uniquely American, I think. And then, of course, you see this pastiche of styles, this appropriation of styles that only exists in the front facade. If you go back to the back of all these houses, they all look the same. It's the front that's different, telling some story of some connection to a past that we're desirous for. So the Edible Estates Project really grew out of this moment. I've been working in architecture offices since I was in high school. That's always been very much what I'm focused on. My community has always been more within the art world. But I've become less and less interested in buildings and more interested in redirecting the unique skills of the architect to other things besides buildings. So when this map happened, here was this, you know, red state, blue state idea that we're a fractured society. And it also corresponded with the kind of disillusionment on my part of the contemporary art and architecture worlds that I'm a part of, feeling like these are these insular dialogues where we're just talking to ourselves, artists creating work for other artists, architects creating work that can really only be fully appreciated by other architects. And I think we do need elevated dialogue within the disciplines, but we probably today more than ever need to turn outside of those disciplines and share what we're doing and engage with a very broad audience about what we're doing. And I really, with this election, my only impulse was to do something, a project for the whole country. Like, was it possible to do something that could be equally appreciated and understood by everyone, and not for these narrow cultural ghettos of the East and West Coast or whatever? And I grew up in Minneapolis. I went to school in Pennsylvania. I worked in Connecticut. I lived in New York and moved to LA. So I thought I was this widely traveled American, when in fact I had hugged exclusively to the blue and somehow managed to not live anywhere in there. And so I just had this idea. It's just the only idea I had was to do a project, and the geographic center is a symbolic first step, which is Kansas. So that's what I did, and I didn't know what it would be. And it was only once I had an invitation and things started to happen. Salina, Kansas is where the first opportunity was to do a project, which is the geographic center of the country. And for some reason, my eyes went right to the space of the front lawn. And growing up in suburban Minneapolis, this was a place that I was very familiar with. I mowed the lawn every weekend. And, you know, I think we're all globally conscious of the front lawn. Even people who don't live in the United States, who just experience our culture through movies, are aware of the lawn. It is the most powerful, iconic visual symbol of the American dream, the American culture, American neighborhood. And it really symbolizes pleasure. It symbolizes originally this idea of the common green, that we're all connected. We're not like those horrible Europeans that wall off their gardens. Like, we're all together, we're gonna tend this space together. So it really does start off from these ideas of democracy and community, but it's evolved into something quite sinister in a way, at least the front lawn, which is what I'm narrowly focused on. This space that represses all evidence of local culture, geography, climate. So here's LA, this is not far from where I live, and I don't know if we get 7 inches of rain a year, something like that, I forget. But here's New Jersey, a lot more rain per year, totally different climate, but identical. And of course, we all know the whole country looks like this. This is nothing unusual. But how remarkable that we should treat these radically different places in such a similar way. And not only that, think of all these people living in these houses. Are they as similar as we should think by these spaces? So it represses not only local culture and climate, but also personal taste and all the eccentricities that we're maybe a little scared of in our neighbors. And it erupts occasionally. We all have the neighbors with the pink flamingos and the crazy displays. And when it erupts like crazy. It doesn't erupt in small ways. It's like a rupture, and then it's like crazy town. Like every neighborhood has that front yard that's just bonkers, and then everyone else is like keeping it under control. So the space of the lawn is a powerful symbol, and I only realized when I started doing the project what a symbol it is once you question its very existence. Can we consider America, what would America look like if the whole front lawn disappeared tomorrow? What would our whole idea of ourselves be? How would it change? And there's a story in the Edible Estates book by the first garden owner in Salina about a neighbor who was telling him, there was some returning soldier from Iraq listing the three things that he missed most. Number one was the lawn, two was pizza. I forget what number three was. But there was something about the lawn that symbolizes this sort of pleasure and luxury and comfort and control, you know? There's profound pleasure associated with it, which I'm not questioning. What I'm starting to question is the 300, oh God, I can't not have my number straight. 30 million acres of lawn in the United States. Anyway, it's the biggest crop. If you count it by a crop, it's like the biggest one in the United States. So the idea that we have so much and it's become so much of the default that we return to when we don't know what else to do to plant a lawn there. And of course, this picture is amazing because I took this in the front yard of a house where they had an Amnesty International sign in the window. And then this. And like, what kind of company puts a sign on their product with kids and animals with an X through them? It's like... It's so amazing to me. I can't even understand how we live with that. Like Amnesty International, and then to actually have something in front of our house that like that. And of course, if we know anything about a space like this, if you know anything about ecology, you know a diverse ecosystem is a healthy one. The less diverse it is, the less healthy it is. And what's less diverse than a lawn? This is a monoculture, which means that everything but that blade of grass needs to be decimated. All forms of plant and animal life, anything that invades that isn't one of those two things needs to be destroyed. So there's a whole laundry list of environmental reasons that depend on where you are. In Southern California, we have, if you go inland, up to 80% of water use is residential landscape, which is mostly lawn. And in Las Vegas, I think they're paying people $1 a square foot to remove lawns and replace them. Some cases, it's water. Of course, there's pesticides that are going here. So that fresh water is being immediately toxified and going into any groundwater. And then we have mowers that are polluting the air. Now, this is all fine and good when it's all in the effort of a treasured space with dogs and children running around having fun and returning soldiers pleasuring themselves on the lawn. Like, that's lovely. We love lawns, like I love lawns. But what happens when all of that is in the service of not only an unused space, but I will even go so far as to call it like a militarized zone. Like this area here where it is made very clear that no one should be comfortable here. The owners of the home do not feel comfortable doing anything here. And you know, as a person on the street, setting foot in that lawn is like sacrilege. We're so familiar with stay off the lawn signs, you almost don't need them anymore because it just says as much just by having one like this. Down to the bay window, which is like surveillance control to make sure that nobody's there. So here it is. And the reason I'm so focused exclusively on the domestic front lawn is because here is a single family with this situation that they've inherited. They haven't even planted it. It's something that they've inherited. And I love this idea that we've all inherited things. A crappy family, a bad neighborhood, whatever. We all inherit the cities we live in. And then at a certain point, you take stock of them. You take responsibility for them. You say, I didn't decide in this, but it's mine now, and I'm going to decide what I want to do with it. And I think there's a great power to, since we do live in a capitalist society, we do have private property, to take advantage of that private property and to have the project be an open invitation to these private property homeowners. What do you want to do with this place you've inherited? How do you want to demonstrate in this place that you do have complete control over how you want not just your place to look, but as a demonstration of what you think our whole neighborhood or city should look like? I think each person's house should be a perfect reflection of what they think the whole city should look like. And the front yard is the most public place to do that. Here is the place where you're saying what you believe in, how you feel. I like Tudor style. Like, that's the most that people are willing to say in their homes these days. But I like the idea that this place in front of the house is an announcement. It's private property. But you know that when you don't mow your lawn for 2 months, it is not private because everyone has something to say about it and everyone's up in arms and freaking out. There's a great story in the book by Michael Pollan telling the story of growing up in Long Island of his father not mowing his lawn for months and months and basically losing all of his friends in the neighborhood and having his last friend come and offer to mow their lawn. And you know that what you do in front of your house says how you feel about your neighbors. It says, this is how I feel about you. This is what I'm giving you. And if you don't mow your lawn, it's a sign to them that you don't care, you hate them, you are a bad person, you're probably immoral, you're probably doing other bad things. Who knows what's going on in that house? I'm interested in that moment, that really amazing threshold between private and public that's so blurred. And here's what's happening too. There's the front door of the house, there's the street. Instead of this vacancy, or maybe what previously used to be a front porch where you would sit out in and have that moment of engagement, you're out there mowing the lawn with maybe even like headphones on. So that's the kind of social symbols you're setting to your neighborhood. Whereas once you start to grow food there, there can't possibly be more, you know, a more social activity. So it's changing the whole dynamics of the space. So what I'd like to do is move you through the gardens that I've been doing for the past few years. When I started the project, my intention was to do one prototype garden in a region of the country, like dividing the country into 9 squares and doing one garden in each square as a prototype of what's possible in that area. Not as a prototype of the coolest, best, perfect garden, but as a typical, inexpensive, easy to do garden that is responsive to that climate and for that unique characteristics of that family in that street. Also, if you've visited my website or seen the book or anything about the project, you know that there's a logo and there's this kind of graphic identity, which I think is very important. And I think in a society where a new and improved shampoo is worthy of millions of dollars campaign, I think I'm interested in engaging in our cultural language of graphic conversation and graphic branding and stuff, which I hate. I mean, when I was in school, people talked about branding and marketing, my eyes would glaze over and I'd get really mad, but now that's like exactly what I'm doing. But I like the idea of taking a ridiculous activity like growing food and then giving it a logo and an identity, and it confuses people because they think it's this huge organization or nonprofit, and there's a staff on phones, and it's just me and a laptop and just this little project that I'm doing. So here are the gardens that I've done so far. There's been 8 planted. I only really can do 1-2 at the most a year because the garden is really the smallest part of it. A lot of the work is telling the story of the gardens. So each one is usually commissioned by a museum or art institution that's contacted me and invited me to do the project. Then I do an open call for whatever situation I'm looking for, whether it's a front lawn or an apartment complex in that place, and then visit a few people and then pick one. And then they're already on board. They've contacted me. So I'm not convincing anyone of anything. They own the property, so there's no red tape. There's no complications of all of that bureaucracy. It's like, who wants to do this? And then the people who do want to do it, ideally, they know about more about gardening in that zone than I do. So I'm coming to work with them in the design and make something happen, catalyze something in that particular place. So going back in time, the first garden was planted on the 4th of July in 2005, coincidentally. But usually they're planted over a long weekend, like 3-day weekend with volunteers. Usually a lot of the materials are donated. And I'm going to great lengths. Sometimes it takes months to find just the right situation. A really typical house, a typical family, something that people could look at and identify with in some way. And this is otherwise a very beautiful place already, but each one of these gardens, this is not a commercial project where people are hiring me and saying, oh, I just want a few tomato plants over there. I've established the terms, and whoever wants to do that contacts me when I do the open call. So the whole point is we're removing the whole lawn, we're replacing it entirely with edibles, and we start out planting everything that will produce food in that climate. And then over time, and they're, all the gardens are permanent as long as the families are there, and then they can see over time what works for them. But I think it's very important for people to see what's possible, like the whole range of possibilities, and you can see very quickly like what you don't like, what you like, what does well, what doesn't. This is after 2 years, and Stan Cox, who's the owner of this garden, works at the Land Institute, a wonderful organization in Salina. So he's replaced most of this with perennials, which of course is very low maintenance, and most of them that are very happy to be in this climate. There are strawberries around the entire perimeter, which I like to do a lot on the sidewalks because it's good for people walking down the street. It's like a very generous thing to have. And now there's like grapevines growing up the house. So I go to great lengths to make them as diverse as possible and also to design in a place for people to hang out. There's usually, well, in this case, we had a huge mound at planting. I always produce a printed brochure telling the story to the neighbors of what happened, because I go also to very great lengths to only plant them in places where nobody else would do this, like where it's going to be shocking and people are going to be confused. So there's usually a sign and brochures to explain to people what happened, and then a local growing planting calendar to show people how they could, what they could plant, and then instructions on composting and irrigation and things like that. So the project is planting gardens, but once the garden is planted, it's not mine anymore. It's the family's, and I disappear, and it's theirs. And they have 100% control over what happens to it. And then my job is mostly like telling the story and getting stories from them and making a video like you may have seen at the beginning and making brochures and having these exhibitions. The website and the book is all part of telling that story. You saw those pictures of Lakewood. This is the family in Lakewood that contacted me, coincidentally. I actually didn't know much about Lakewood when they first got in touch, but I was very excited when I realized where this was and the possibility for having the second garden there, because that's happening at the same time as Levittown in the late 40s, really the beginning of the pervasive front lawn as we know it today. So to be able to go to that community and remove one of those lawns and do this was really exciting. So you wouldn't know it from this picture, but they had an amazing garden in the backyard at this time with chickens. And they had a blog charting the egg production of their hens. And I thought, these are the perfect people. Not only are they interested in growing food already, but they want to share the stories of it. And the reason what I'm doing is different than a commercial project is because the garden is only one small part of what I'm doing. The bigger thing I'm doing is telling the stories and somehow sharing what's happening in these places and holding these up as examples, not as idealized gardens, but as to say, oh, what if we did this? And then telling the story of like, here's what happened when someone did. And then here it is after. This is just after about 3 months. And every garden, the design is different. In this case, it's these symmetrical, curvy spirals that are kind of drawing people in off the street. Here it is just after a month or two after planting. And you can see what a, you know, it's meant to be this vivid contrast with everything else around it. The whole point of the gardens that I'm doing is it should be a shock, a total shock to the system. Like, half my job is identifying moments, strategic moments to do this. because context is everything. If I did this on a hippie street in Portland, it would mean nothing. But it needs to be in a place where it will be surprising, and you can drive down the street, and even someone who's never been there would know something happened here, like something very strange happened here. And I don't have the opportunity to go door to door and find out what people think, but when this garden was planted, there was a New York Times, like totally old school New York Times reporter, who visited and went door to door and knocked on the doors and said, what do you think of that garden? And this was very early in the process. And most people were pretty concerned, a lot of them about property values, some of them about potential vegetable thieves or rodents. I think that changed pretty quickly after the garden filled in, and it always does. But you know, when the press tells the story, they want conflict, so they always want to say, like, everyone hates it, people are freaking out, when in fact, most people like them when they're there. It's that first moment of seeing it that things shift in your mind. I think for some people that desire control, that are afraid of eccentricity, that are afraid of a little bit of wildness, find it threatening. And some people, even after the garden's filled in after a few years, still hate it. And still, like, there's the family in New Jersey, this one, the family on the left in this half-timber house, these elderly German immigrants, loved the garden. The family on the right hated it, and I think she still hates it. And every time she sees any sort of animal, she's like, blames it on this garden. So this is the second garden, or the third garden in New Jersey. Again, there's all volunteers. This is a series of a grid of raised beds. Just after a few months, it had totally filled in. And I like to plant gardens where, when it fills in, all you see are plants. It's no fancy hardscaping or architectural constructions or complicated, expensive things that get in the way of the main point of the project. In some cases, some are more wild than others. You can see the one in Salina is just mulched with straw, which most people wouldn't feel comfortable with. This is kind of different kinds of bark. But I like gardens where all you can see are plants when it's filled in. And when anyone looks at it, they can imagine doing that themselves, or even better. They're not meant to be aspirational gardens. They're not meant to be held up on a pedestal for people to strive to, knowing they're never going to achieve. And frankly, I think that's one of the most tragic parts of our society today. I derive great pleasure from seeing beautiful homes, beautiful people, beautiful clothes, beautiful stuff that I know I can never have. I think we all derive great pleasure from that. But I think we've turned the corner to a dark and sinister place where that has been held up to us and we've confused it with real pleasure. And it isn't pleasure. It is one of the most, it is created within ourselves culturally, deep, deep anxiety, and I think is at the root, is the root cause of our environmental problems today, is this idea that we are not citizens or human beings, we're consumers, and our job is not to participate in communities, it's to buy things, and the way we get out of a crisis is to shop our way through it. And I think all the projects I'm interested in doing are turning, always are reflexive and always turn themselves back on ourselves, saying, what are we uniquely capable of where we are, not what is out there that we need to have, that if we have, we can do what we need to do. Everything that I do in my projects, anyone could do themselves, and that's kind of the whole point. So here you can see what a contrast it is with the rest of the street. This garden is in London. This was commissioned by Tate Modern, and the whole point of this project also is to do them in every garden is a different situation of how people are living today. In this case, public housing in London, council housing estates. This was this very unique piece of land that was open just south of Tate Modern in an area of London called Southwark, one of the least green parts of the city. This piece of green that was gated off that was only occasionally attracting you know, dogs and drunks. So when I came there to do this project, we knocked on all the doors of everyone there saying what we were thinking of doing, making a garden that everyone could participate in to grow food there. We only had one super enthusiastic person. Everyone was skeptical. One person said, why can't we just park cars there? One person, when I was there taking measurements, came out screaming at me. I don't know if you saw her in the video, the London video. She was pointing at that painting she was making of the council estates, and she was pointing at all the people in the painting. her. She came out running at me, screaming, like, who are you? What are you doing? I heard you're taking down my trees and ruining my green place. Like, this is the only green space I have. And I kind of talked her down. And was like, no, we're not taking down any trees. We're just making a little garden here. And she was very skeptical. And any change that happens in that neighborhood is always bad. And she was just not having it. And then she watched us plant it through the weekend. And she's, like, the biggest fan of the garden now. And she's, like, painting pictures of it and stuff. But this idea of the garden as a public place that people are looking at is very important. All the gardens that I do are meant to be looked at. They're not meant to be hidden in the backyard, or in this case, there was space behind this complex, but it needs to be in the most visible place we could find, because it's not just about the people who are gardening, the families who decide to garden and grow food. It's everyone else who's watching, because everyone else who's watching, like I said about the compost pile, is getting a daily reminder and is seeing, like, oh yeah, plants, food comes from plants. And it doesn't have to be any big breakthrough, we already know that, but at least they're seeing evidence of it. And for a lot of kids that live in cities, it isn't something they know already. Why should a kid know that a tomato comes from a plant? There's no reason that they should know that based on their daily experience in the city or in the supermarket. Tomatoes come wrapped in plastic and styrofoam. To see it coming up from a plant is a truly shocking sight for a lot of children in cities. And I'll show you the one in New York. So the idea that these gardens that you watch grow, that you watch people tend, the idea that when you're watching a garden like this, you have a stake in it and you're a participant just by the very nature of being a witness to it, I think. So all these gardens, these lone gardens in Lakewood, for example, even if they're the only people growing food publicly in the city of Lakewood, at least everyone else is aware of it and watching it. And maybe that's all, that's enough. So this garden, it's a very kind of elaborate shape inspired by these kind of fancy raised bed gardens and the Royal Parks and Buckingham Palace and stuff like that, which I was really inspired by. And I also like the idea that this garden could be confused with the pleasure landscape. It would use all the devices of a purely pleasure garden, but it happens to produce food. And then there's this meeting circle in the middle. Here it is after it's been planted. And now they've grown, they planted the top of that shed and there's vines growing up and down everything. So this garden, these gardens have different challenges. In this case, everyone who wants to grow food here can. There's no plots, it's a communal garden. Everyone just negotiates the spaces themselves and it works. There's places that are made for people. But also because there's a lot of kids, this is a huge garden for kids, there's very clear spaces for people and plants. And it's kind of laid out like this with these tentacle arms so anyone can reach in and garden from a people place, right? So there's no pathways, there's no stepping stones. Everyone has access to reach in and garden from the lawn or the walking area. And it's become kind of a little UN, like this is a super diverse neighborhood in London. So there's people from India, from Bangladesh, from all over the world that are growing food here, that are having seeds sent from their families. So all these kind of exotic things are being planted next to each other. And whenever I'm in London, I'm always visiting, and it's always a pleasure to see what's going on just happening by. And usually it's a mom and some kids, like, weeding or whatever. And then as the garden has established itself, people who had never heard the word composting before, had no idea what it was, now have a very sophisticated composting system there that originally they were very freaked out and confused about. But now it's just part of the culture there, and it's spreading to a lot of the council housing estates there as well. And they're also starting to do rainwater catchment and stuff like that. And then as things got more fancy, we have this like stainless steel raised bed so they can continually add more compost and it'll become elevated. One important thing to note here, this is a highly contaminated site, as is much of South London, very industrial. So we actually had to lay down an impervious layer of material called geotex, I think, that's impervious to roots, so that actually this is a fully functioning raised bed situation where no roots are going into the existing ground. So when I'm doing these projects, every place I go or whenever I'm talking about them, the first questions are always local. Like when I'm in Alaska, it's like, what do we do about the moose? When it's in London, it's like, well, it's contaminated, so what do we do about that? So like, there's so many challenges with growing food, And all of the challenges are local, and I don't know any of the solutions, and I'm not there providing any, because everything is reflexive. Everything is turning back on itself. So whenever there's a question, it's like, well, maybe you should ask your neighbor, or maybe you guys should figure that out, or maybe like this is a good opportunity to come to terms with that, or this, suddenly you have to like, you know, find out what's going on around you. Because I have people from Australia or, you know, France, whatever, emailing me about what to do with their gardens. It's like, I don't know. Like, how would I possibly know that? You have a very particular situation there that you need to convene on and find out about, you know? And I think we've become so dependent on a global system of information that's so powerful when the information is global, which, of course, most of the 20th century means of production and construction were global. All of the systems that I'm interested in and all the systems that I think are going to change the way we're living in a positive way are going to be hyper-local, buttressed by powerful global communication systems. It's like taking the best of the technologies that exist, like the web, like email, like digital cameras, very simple devices that everyone has that they can use then to be in touch more locally about what's happening. So each garden that I do is presented locally in a form of an exhibition or a display, in this case, in the Turbine Hall at Tate Modern. This huge table is set up with a little reading library, a graphic display about the garden, videos about the comparing the London and LA garden. The garden in Austin, I really wanted to do an apartment complex there because I would have been invited by an art institution in Austin to do the project. Specifically, they said, we'd really love for you to come and do an edible estate garden here. And of course, when I was putting together the book, I did an open call, finding out, getting stories. I wanted a story from every growing zone in the country from someone who was already growing food in their front yard, and they were included in the book. A third of those stories came from Austin, Texas. And here I was showing up to Austin to do a front yard garden, like, hey guys, we're gonna be crazy and grow food in the front yard, and meanwhile, everyone's doing that. So I really, and at that point in the project too, wanted to look at different situations. So I really was very focused exclusively on doing an apartment complex, a situation where people feel like they have no stake in the land around them, where people feel very isolated from the land around them. So this garden was planted mostly with children. It was all the kids that showed up. Kids who, if you had invited them the day before to garden, they would have run away. But probably 25 kids ages 10 to 18 were there morning till night, 3 days without being asked, that did all the work, basically. All the adults were like, I don't know, I don't think this will work, or, you know, well, I think I've worked that day, or it's our weekend, I don't know. You know, there's all the excuses why the adults couldn't be bothered. And it's always the case, it's always the kids who are the most eager and enthusiastic and least skeptical. And that's every single garden that I've done. Always the kids. Salina, Kansas, roving gang of like 5 kids showed up the first day and we couldn't get rid of them. And at first I was scared of them because I thought they were going to ruin everything. But the cool thing about having kids involved is that you know when they planted something, they're going to be watching it and they're going to be paying attention to it. And these gardens are permanent. They're going to be growing up with them, and they're going to be wanting to eat everything that's come out of it. And these kids, like every single garden, are the most involved people. And in a way, I've kind of given up on adults. Like, adults are just kind of an annoyance, a temporary annoyance, because they're not going to be around much longer. And we really don't really need to bother with them much, because they've screwed everything up already. And the kids, like, are so eager and impressionable. And they haven't been, you know, appropriately schooled in why they should be afraid of wild things in the neighborhood. You know, that hasn't been drilled out of them yet. So here's the wild things. And I really welcome gardens. My ideal garden is this. My ideal garden is extremely organized and very well planned and very structured, with very strategically planted perennials and trees and shrubs that I know are going to be there forever. Paths, ways of moving, a design that's responsive to how people are going to use it and the situation. And then an enormous amount of freedom within that for it to change and evolve as people want to change it, as they want to plant different things. But also as things sprout up, like I love volunteer tomato plants that sprout in the middle of the path and suddenly have a tomato And usually, frankly, those are the healthiest tomato plants in my experience. Like, the ones that I lavish a lot of attention on always die. And the volunteer that grows in the back is the, like, the crazy thing that I can't get rid of that is in LA producing tomatoes year-round, practically. So here are the kids. And these kids were just so enthusiastic. And I have since been in touch with all of the owners of all the gardens, all the kids, everyone, to get their stories for the new edition of the book, which is coming out in a few months. And it's very satisfying to hear the experience of these kids in particular and how, what an impression the garden has made on them and what a, you know, how it's kind of changed the culture there. And this is, I have a schoolhouse that started at my geodesic dome in LA and it's kind of mobile now. So all of my projects have companion educational programs. This one was called How to Eat Austin that I referred to. So every week someone came and talked about growing food in Austin, starting out with dirt and compost in week one, and week eight was cooking. So if you came every week, you could go from dirt to cooking. And then we were growing seedlings for the garden there too, and there was an information wall. So my shows and museums are not exhibitions, they're headquarters, is how I choose to think of them. And maybe if I have time, I'll show you a few more pictures. This was the one in Baltimore, which was just planted last year, the Ridgely family. He had been in an extreme arms race with his neighbors of who had the best lawn. He was very proud of his front lawn. One day he was just Googling berry bushes in the front yard or something because he wanted to plant some berry bushes there. He had food in the backyard. And he came up with my website and realized that day I'd made an open call for Baltimore and he just happened to get in touch. So here it is just a few months after planting. This, again, is a very simple, primitive planting strategy of mounded plantings, which is very typical of Native American planting techniques, mounded plants, raised beds kind of. And on the left is kind of a meadow of wildflowers and a little mini orchard of fruit trees. Here it is right after planting. Now you can see the difference between these gardens and those on your reality TV programs is that usually in the TV programs when they leave it looks like done, like the garden is done, but of course the garden is never done, and actually when I leave it looks like this, which, you know, everyone's just like, what, that's the garden? And no, it's, you know, we're starting from seeds, we're starting from seedlings. Gardens are just beginning on this day and it's in its infancy, and it'll be years before it comes into its own, but this is what the beginning of a garden looks like, I think. And it needs to look like this. And when it evolves from this to this, everyone's like, wow, you know? Like, we want that satisfaction of 3 months watching it arrive at this. You know, for all the neighbors to see that happen. And there's Clarence. He wrote such a wonderful story for the book, too. Because the amazing thing about this garden is that it's so big for him and his two kids that his neighbors have started to sneak in and plant their own little food in there. And they're also stealing things. One morning, he was watching a melon grow for like 3 months, and he's like, came out in the morning to finally get it, and he came out to see his neighbor. It's like, oh, thanks for the melon, Clarence. Like, she had just taken it that morning. So it's a very open public space, and all of the problems that you would imagine with public gardening happen. But it's kind of a default community garden in a way. Everyone has participated in this garden, if not growing, planting, then watching it. Everyone's watching that melon. You know, not just Clarence. So for this garden, the Descanso Gardens in LA invited me to do a garden there. This is the only kind of institutional garden that I did. And I used it as an opportunity to do a demonstration garden to show what's possible. So we had this, I built this shed. And on the left, we planted a lawn. And the right, we planted an edible estate. And then people could walk down that sidewalk and see what each one felt like. And these people who go there like every weekend so they can see how it changes over time. And then we had local fourth graders that put in input and output. What went into which side? What came out of that side? Like food, water, pollution, whatever. Highly unscientific, frankly. I mean, the kids were measuring leaves, like this leaf is 4 inches long and now it's 4.5 inches long. But it was important for them to document that, I think. So we're planting the lawn on the left. And then this fake house, ghost of a house, will be this kind of interpretive display center with information about the lawn and its attributes on one side and the information about the garden on the other. And you can see as the garden grew, this amazing Italian squash completely overtook the right side of the house with these huge pendulous squash, like bigger than the fourth graders, like hanging from the top. So here it is right after planting. And you can see as it's changed over time. And you can see how dramatic, like how much it was the same on the left side and how much the right side changed. Like every day there was something different on the right side. Every week you would come back, something's different is happening. And on the left, it's like always the same. Maybe someone forgot to water and it gets a little brown. That's the most pleasure you would get from any sort of variety on the left side. And they're the fourth graders. And this, again, all the gardens that I'm doing are demonstration gardens, there to demonstrate what's possible, but here that was its whole function. Now, the most recent garden, which was planted in Manhattan, I had been invited by, I don't know if any of you are familiar with the High Line Project in New York, taking this abandoned elevated railway on the west side of Manhattan and turning it into a park, which the first phase of which has just been completed up until 22nd Street, which has been a phenomenal success. It's just a beautiful space that you can't even believe exists, and it's really changed a lot of people's idea of the city and what's possible, really, in New York. And a lot of, you know, frankly, people all over the world are carefully studying that as a model of how other vestiges of the industrialized parts of our city can be reimagined into public amenities. So anyway, they had invited me to do a garden in some area around the High Line because the High Line's elevated and it has to the west the most famous contemporary art galleries and now some of the most expensive new condo developments, and to the east some of the least prosperous parts of Manhattan, like huge public housing projects by NYCHA, the New York Public Housing Authority, of which this site was for. So we had the amazing opportunity of a 2,500 square foot piece of land facing south with full solar exposure in the middle of Manhattan that was available. And what I chose to do was a garden not literally providing food for the residents, because frankly that just wasn't possible for the scale that's here and for that place. I mean, it's just too much to contend with growing food there. And instead, I viewed this as a portal into the past and the future. And I worked with Eric Sanderson, who I'll talk about in a moment, who founded the Manhattan Project. I don't know if you've heard about that. He's been spending a decade figuring out what the island of Manhattan looked like 400 years ago when the European settlers first arrived. And when they did arrive, there were 400 or 500 Lenape people living on the island. So I wanted to look at how were those people eating, and I planted exclusively plants producing food that they would have eaten. So either the cultivars that they were growing, corn, squash, and beans, three sisters, or the native plants. So you can see the plan here. There's a gathering circle, there's kind of woodland zone, a berry patch, but there's only 20 plants. Here is the kind of images that Eric Sanderson is making. He has created this imaging software that can literally take a picture of any place on the island at that moment in 1609. And he's identified a particular time of day. I think it's 2 p.m., September 10th, 1609, is supposedly the moment when Henry Hudson arrived, the first European to set foot there. What did that place look like? And he knows down to the insects, the plants, the trees, the rock outcroppings, the rivers. And here's a similar Lenape garden that had been planted at the New York Botanic Gardens. So here's the site before planting. Here it is. Here we are planting. There's just a lot of volunteers. Now, when we finish planting again, there's that kind of anticlimactic moment for the residents where they were confusing these mounds with burial mounds. I mean, it looks very kind of tragic. It does not look like a garden yet. But these are our three sisters mounds. So every spring, the kids are going to go out there because there's a children's center associated with this. And you plant corn, and the corn starts to grow. And then you plant beans, and the beans grow up the corn. And then squash around that, which shades the soil, keeps the weeds down, keeps the moisture in. And it's a very common planting technique. And it means that you're planting things every season from scratch, annuals. They're growing up and exploding, and then they're dying And if you ever, any of you seen dead corn, like, it's gorgeous. But of course, in our world, in our uncivilized culture, we view those dead corn as like an eyesore, something to get rid of. Most of us maybe are uncomfortable with evidence of death in our landscape. It's not something we as Americans really want to have around us. But I think that's like the beautiful part of fall, that moment when these corn stalks have dried up and they're these like dry shells and the beans are still kind of growing up them. And here it is just a few weeks later when the corn and beans started to sprout. And here we are after planting. So it's been very challenging growing a lot of these perennials or native edible plants, some of which are very rare and obscure and very hard to get, and it's figuring out how to plant them here is really hard now, which is phenomenal when you think, like, this is exactly where that plant is supposed to be. Like, it's native to that soil. And how amazing that people were eating this food for millennia on this piece of land, and if you showed them what people on that island are eating today, I mean, how would you even begin to describe some of these things that we're eating? And the same foreignness that we have to some of these plants, like Jerusalem artichoke is a kind of sunflower, produces these really delicious roots, like potato kind of things, which most of us have never seen or had before, and yet this is something people are eating for millennia on this island, and you showed a Jerusalem artichoke to anyone on the island today, and they have no idea what that is. And then the fact that it's hard to grow now in the city, you know, for whatever reason, squirrels or rats or, you know. So the next edition of the book, which this is the new cover, which is, you're like the first ones to see it practically, which I'm so excited that Clarence is on the cover weeding. So it's like the before and after picture. So this is an expanded edition with all 8 gardens and all the stories from all the homeowners with a new essay by Will Allen, who does Growing Power in Detroit. And he hasn't written much, but this is his first manifesto on the food revolution, basically. So it's really exciting to have it in the book. And if any of you happen to be in New York in the spring, we'll be having some big events in the middle of April in New York around the release of the book with him and Michael Pollan, hopefully, and some other people. That's still just being planned. So I think I have a little bit of time, quickly, to just talk about the animal estates, which is not having animals that you eat in front of your house, which some of my friends thought it was when I first told them about it. It's about... it's about kind of returning to my identity as an architect and my longtime interest in animals. And the original idea for the project was to go to cities the way I do with the garden projects and talk to local experts and find out which animals are native to this place that have been marginalized by people that we might want to have back, that could be accommodated in a man-made construction. And in a way, these animals would be treated as my clients. I would be studying them to find out what they need and being designed something for them responsive to their needs. So it's exactly the same thing as an architect-client relationship, except my clients, I never meet them, I never see them, I never talk to them. It's mediated through local experts that I talk to. So these all just happened in 1 year, last year, 2008. So all of these additions happened in that 1 year. And it was launched in front of the Whitney Museum. And as I said, the branding becomes ridiculous with animal estates because each city has its seal and its logo around a particular animal. And this identity is less commercial, it's more institutional. And I think a lot of people that see it thinks it's like official federal, well, maybe not with the beavers, but like a federal seal. I mean, it looks kind of official, bureaucratic. Ideally. So the idea was each place I go, there's only one thought that I arrive to the city with, which is who are the animals that were here before and which ones can we live with again through things that I could make for them? And then how it manifests itself is totally open to the institution that's invited me, the experts that I meet, the situation in that city. In New York, I had no idea what I was going to do for the first one because I had been invited to do something for the front of the Whitney Museum in Manhattan for the Whitney Biennial, which is like March. So there's no animals that I could imagine like, you know, forcing to to be in this place and that part of the city at that time. And it's important that all my projects be fully functioning. They're not symbolic, they are all real. They're not about something, they are something. They're very pragmatic. So the preceding summer, I had read an article in the New Yorker about Eric Sanderson, who I mentioned doing the Manhattan Project, and I emailed him, and he was really eager to be involved, and he became the primary inspiration for the project. That is, who are the animals that lived at the corner of 75th and Madison, where the Whitney Museum is now, 400 years ago? And he knows exactly which animals were there. Not maybe, but he gave me a huge list, like, these animals were there. They were where the museum is now. And from that list, we narrowed it down to 12 that could be reintroduced into the city with things that I would make for them. Now, the great thrill about working with Eric Sanderson is that as a someone who's trained as an architect that's more working in the art world, it's almost kind of scary the degree to which I become a generalist, I feel like, and I have deep, deep respect for specialists, like people who know everything about a certain butterfly. Like, I love that person and I want to talk to them and find out what they know and work with them. So there's some pairing between what I do and what they do that's so wonderful because they have some sort of deep knowledge that they're not particularly well schooled, you know, they haven't been trained to communicate. And I just want to know and share stories, and I'm looking for stories and I'm looking for information that can be used in these particular situations that I'm making. Anyway, so Eric Sanderson is, you know, and sometimes scientists don't really want to bother, they don't understand, or they just want to do their narrow little research and they don't have a desire to extend it like that. But some scientists, the ones I love working with, are like, love that opportunity of that sort of expansive conversation that's usually not possible with their work. And feeding everything that they've been doing into something else that then can be shared publicly. And as I said, like, we have, through 8 years of federal government, a virtual campaign against the sciences, virtually, I think, placing the sciences in a really unfortunate situation of, I think the sciences were already in an unfortunate situation of not having a proper voice in our society. There's amazing stories and things being understood and found out that are not being shared publicly, not because, it's just because the right connections haven't been made. And I think even more so after those 8 years, the sciences have been pushed down even more to the point where they're in this defensive position of having to defend themselves as opposed to being in this powerful position of being a voice, like a powerful voice in our society for what's happening, like what's happening in the world around us, like we want to know. And I think in this case in Manhattan, what a powerful thing to find out, not what's going to happen or what's happening, but what happened. Like this city that's so impossibly humanized at this point was 400 years ago home to only about 400 people. And that's like nothing. And we take it so for granted the degree to which it's been, you know, claimed by us today. So here's my installation in front of the Whitney Museum. Usually the sculpture court there, it's occupied by a very monumental sculpture. I wanted to do something that was very modest, that you almost disappeared in a way. So this is the estate for the barn owl at the corner of Madison and 75th. This is the most expensive zip code in the United States, by the way. And this barn owl at the corner of Madison and 75th, this is like super pricey real estate. And this is the squirrel, flying squirrel back here, you could almost miss. And the bald eagle, of course. This is a 10-foot diameter nest. They can weigh up to 2 tons. And this was placed on the entry portico. And this is an amazing building. This is one of my favorite buildings of all time by Marcel Breuer. And it's also a very austere building. And the sculpture court looks like a zoo display. It's a recessed pit that looks like wild animals should be down there. So I placed these bronze plaques around the perimeter telling the story of these 12 animals so you could look at the plaques and then look down and kind of see, okay, where's the bobcat? And of course people assumed there was a bobcat down there. And my favorite thing that happened during this project, and there's a beaver pond and there's the eagle's nest. My favorite thing that happened is when someone told me they were in line to go into the museum one day and they heard these ladies behind them talking about the show and the projects, and then they were looking into the sculpture court, and they were like, oh yeah, this isn't art. This isn't part of the show, this is something else. They're gonna have art here for the next show, but this is you know, some local organization doing this, but it's not art. And to me, that was the most exciting news possible, that I could spend an enormous amount of time and money producing a project that occupied the entire front of a museum, and that everyone looking at would be convinced that it was not art, and it was something that was put there for other reasons or whatever. Because I'm not trying to make art. Art happens when you least expect it, I think, and I'm not willfully trying to make art. I'm starting first with ideas. I'm starting first with impulses. I'm starting first with like things I'm interested in, that I'm curious about. It could manifest itself as a video. It could manifest itself as a garden or this animal project, whatever. And if people who present art invite me to do it, then it is art for that moment. If a botanical institution invites me to do it, then for that moment, I'm a gardener and it's a gardening project. But I really don't care. To me, the ideas are of the prime importance, and how they trickle down into a discipline or into a final form is happens naturally. And I think this is really interesting given the way this school is organized, because just hearing from how the school is organized, it's like every university is trying to figure out how to do this. They're all talking about interdisciplinary and how to break down the barriers between these disciplines, like, and nobody can do it because there's these budgets and schedules and like chain of commands and hierarchy that makes it virtually impossible for even the best intentioned people to do it. And every school I've taught at, they're obsessed with it, and it's all they can talk about it, and they keep trying to do it, and it kind of works, but not quite. And it's kind of how I'm functioning with my work today, but not because I've decided to, it's just what I've naturally been drawn to. But I think it's very interesting what you have here, and I think it's very unusual, and it's something that a lot of people are becoming much more interested in. So there's the Beaver Lodge. Now, I'm super obsessed with Marcel Breuer, so I wanted to design a Beaver Lodge, like homage to Marcel Breuer, so I thought, okay, if Marcel Breuer designed a beaver pond, a beaver lodge, a beaver dam, what would it look like? So that's kind of what I made here. And the beaver is the primary animal here, and it's a creator of habitat for a lot of other animals. These are for the purple martins. Because I call these model homes, these are homes that anyone could look at and imagine making themselves, except the eagle's nest and the beaver pond. The flags are kind of like any model home development. And the federal flag is the eagle. And I was really interested in the eagle as the great symbol for this first edition of the project. In our federal government, the eagle is used to symbolize power, with talons, like really sharp, and wings outspread. But we also know that the eagle is our great introduction to the modern environmental movement. With Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, we learned that DDT was weakening the eggshells of the bald eagles. And suddenly, this powerful animal that was a symbol of our powerful country was the first, most visible kind of victim of our reckless behavior in a way, and how gorgeous that simultaneity of that animal and what it symbolizes, like the most vulnerable and the most powerful. So I've replaced the American flag with the flag of that eagle, and then I've replaced the New York State flag with the flag of the beaver, and the beaver is the foundation of the New York economy originally, and it's also the great builder of communities. I mean, it is making possible habitat for all the other animals that are here. And there was a beaver here. There were beaver dams at this headwaters where the Whitney is located now. And it was important to me to determine that, you know. And I was there every day for months, really, doing this project, because there were weekly events too. And every day I went in, the guard was like, when's the beaver coming? When's the beaver coming? Because I never said officially there were no animals here. I always left it open, like, what? Maybe. So they're always waiting for the beaver to show up. So as with the gardens, that installation was only one very small part of the project. Every week, a different person came to do a talk or performance about one of the animals, either a very esoteric scientific presentation on an animal or a performance. So someone came and talked about possums. My friend Emily Lacey, who's a wonderful folk singer, wrote songs about the flying squirrels and performed those. And then my friend, performance artist Kate Hardy, came as the bobcat. Just kicked off the Animal Estates reality TV show, and she gave her final elimination speech saying why the possum was all up in her face and having an affair with the eagle, and she got kicked off, blah, blah, blah. So if you, there's a wonderful video with her performance on YouTube, and if you want to look it up, Kate Hardy. But these kids were just totally suspended belief, and we had a press conference downstairs, and they asked her questions about what it was like. And then I'm really interested in dance too, and I've worked a lot with contemporary dancers in New York, and I invited 12 of them to write a score of movement inspired by each one of the 12 animals. And then every week they learned all of them. One person would start at the top level and perform these movements at the strata at which those animals used to be there. So they would start with the eagle on the top floor and work their way down to the turtles on the bottom floor. So these are the turtles in the bookstore. And it wasn't, people wouldn't really know what's going on. Some people kind of did, but it would just be like, oh, well, there's the turtles. And then we had one big day in the armory where we had what's called animal drills. This hall for military drills was used for animal drills, where all dancers performed all 12 movements and then instructed everyone who was there in those movements. So it's kind of like a new kind of military drill, but instead of militaristic, it was like animals. This is the eagle. Now I'm going to breeze very quickly through these just to show a few of the other additions. This was at MIT, Makings of Very Simple Animal Homes around Frank Gehry's new building. At SF MoMA, it was more about events. This, if you know anything about the wonderful sea lions at Pier 39, I was really interested in what are the animal estates that people are already making. And this is the best example, like sea lions show up, sink all the piers. The smart people engineer new piers just for the sea lions. These are sea lion animal estates that have been engineered for them, and I got the plans from the people who did it too. It's really amazing. And then this is my favorite animal estate at all. It's just a board of wood that you throw on the ground, a cover board for the slender salamander. So we had kids customizing their slender salamander estate. And there's always the headquarters, like I said. So I have like 10 geodesic domes that travel around as headquarters for these different projects. And there's an ongoing archive of local wildlife information, travels from city to city. Each city adds new information to it. I think it'll be coming to San Francisco again in the spring. And then there's field guides for each one that were produced, stories written by all the experts. And then I think this is the last story that I'll tell you, so we have some time for questions. When I got to Portland, since this is Pacific Northwest, again, I come with an empty head, like a pretty much an idiot. Like I'm an idiot wherever I show up, and I'm looking for who the people are who do this. And then usually just a few emails or phone calls, I find the five people. And they're like, oh, did you call Fran yet? And I'm like, yeah, I called Fran. Like someone else, you know, Bob told me about Fran. Like within a day, I can find out this small network of people that are focused on urban wildlife. So they all were talking about the snag, which is the dead tree, which is the first thing that's removed in a human-managed landscape for legal reasons, I suppose. But I'm really interested in the life of the tree and, again, death in the landscape. If you know anything about trees, you know it has a significant role that exists outside of its small window of life. It's a vertical home after it's dead. Woodpeckers carve out cavities for a lot of different animals. More than half the animals that live in the Pacific Northwest depend on these trees and their cavities to live in them. And then it falls over, and you know, when it's horizontal, it has a life of its own. And then back full circle to the compost picture I told you at the beginning, this thing has a vital life that exists outside of our narrow little obsession with pretty life, you know, alive trees. And you know, as soon as it dies, let's you know, get rid of it. And get rid of it. What's that? You know, where does that go? Because we don't get rid of anything. That abstract idea of trash is rendered impossible with compost, right? Compost shows us there is no away. Anything that throws away goes back in somehow and gets reconstituted into something else or not. So my goal was to put on my hat of the architect again and to say, like, okay, we don't have snags anymore, so if I was an architect and I had the program, the brief, to design a snag for seven animals that I've identified that should live in it, what would it look like? So this was my attempt at a new snag, using this as a prototype. that anyone in the city could take their own stab at what their version of a snag would look like. So this faces south, the bats in these louvers painted black to absorb the heat of the sun facing south, the rocks facing south for the snakes to sun themselves over hibernaculum for the snakes, these trees for the beetles, this little magenta tube for these bees. And the whole thing is a big chimney shaft for the swifts that will nest in that cavity through the top. And then my favorite little bit is this little thing that kicks up at the end for the flycatcher. So when I'm sitting across from the animal expert meeting about the plans, I'm like, oh, how do you think this animal will like this? Is this good? Is there anything else we should do? And we were talking like she's my client. And she's like, well, you know, that perch for the flycatcher is nice, but you know, he really likes to be higher than everything else. Is there any way you can make it like just a little bit more elevated for him so he really is on top? So I like kinked it up a bit for him. And that idea of negotiating for these particular needs of the animals is what this project is all about. And it's all grown out of a very conventional client-architect relationship of finding out, you know, what they need and then responding with the design to suit their needs. And then these posters were displayed around the city, inviting everyone to design their own snag. And it was given as a, you know, an assignment in art schools and stuff. So anyone could submit their plans and designs to be displayed in the gallery as well. And they're part of the ongoing archive, so I have a lot of those that are being displayed. And then every animal that I've worked with, we've created a postcard for them, telling some story on the back with a picture on the front. And then the last one's the Netherlands. This is the headquarters there. And the Netherlands, it was supposed to be about the animals, but really it was about the experts. So I made a documentary about these five experts, these five animals, and the simple things that you can do for them in that landscape. And again, like there's these videos you can all see online. There's tons of videos about these different projects. But this last one is the feeding station, which looks very similar to the compost pile, which comes out only for a few months in the spring. The Red Admiral butterfly will use that as a feeding station, and it's a good way to welcome those butterflies back into the city. But you know, I think I should end it there, so we have, some little bit of time for questions. So does anyone have any questions?
Yeah. Have you heard
our art yet? And so, I've heard about it, but I just got here this afternoon, so I haven't seen anything yet. But I have time tomorrow, so I hope to. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The Olympic Farming Project was, at Tate Modern, they had a panel discussion about the future of London, and for some reason they invited me from LA. It's like, so random in a way. It was like Zaha Hadid and all these kind of distinguished London people, and then me just talking about gardens, basically. But I made a proposal for 2012. Basically, the question was, what should London look like in 2012 for the Olympics? And my proposal was to make a new Olympic event, Olympic farming. And that all of the food that would be eaten by all the Olympic visitors would be produced entirely within the city limits of the city. And we calculated how much land that would be, where it would happen, and then strategizing this idea that there would be Olympic farming teams with beautiful costumes that would be running around the city with carts, and that there would be like superstar farmers that would be like the most, our new celebrities on the front of all the tabloids that people would be gossiping about would be farmers and not pop singers. And we'd be like speculating their personal lives and whatever. But there has been a huge amount of, you know, London, all the cities that I'm visiting, everywhere I go, everyone's interested in this. There's been this huge rise of interest in food and where it's coming from and how we're living in cities. They're all converging on this. And London in particular, there's a lot of interest there. And it so happens that the Olympic Park and Victoria Park, nearby where it's going, is they've actually just removed a lot of the allotment gardens for the Olympic Park. So there's been a huge uprising over that. But there's amazing London organizations focused on doing this. And something's happening. Of course, the budget for the Olympics there is just totally tanked. And all these fancy, like, buildings that they want to make, they don't quite have the budgets for, and yet these gardens that would cost almost nothing are like, you know, it would be the easiest, cheapest, most dramatic thing you could possibly do. So I think something will happen. Yeah.
Hi. Thank you.
Yeah.
I have a question
Yeah, the people that I've done the gardens for.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And the neighbors and.
Yeah.
So what's coming out from there?
Yeah. I don't know. It's interesting, isn't it? One thing I want to make clear, too, is these projects may seem to be about animals. They may seem to be about gardens and food and lawns, but they're really not. They're like the easiest leading wedge into a broad mainstream dialogue about how we're living. And when you see your neighbor start to grow food where we all think you should have a lawn, suddenly the whole city starts to unravel. Like your whole conception of this construction, both physical and mental, that we've created starts to fall apart when you realize that we've all made it ourselves and we all either reinforce it each day or start to pick it apart. So for me, the lawn is like the most dramatic. Turning a lawn into a garden is the most dramatic, easy, quick way to start to unravel the city and start to have us all collectively question it. And a garden is just a device. It's like a tool for doing that in a way. And the families, it's all different, I suppose. I think some people, they just want a free garden because everything's paid for and it's made for them. These are all people who are interested in gardening already. I think in the neighborhoods that I'm doing this, in the more extreme suburban neighborhoods, it would be very difficult as a member of the neighborhood in good standing to suddenly go out and do this, because everyone might kind of hate you. But if you've got some crazy person from another city coming in and doing it, then it's like with a name and a logo and a book, and it's like it's official and it's sanctioned, and suddenly people have to pay attention and take it seriously, which is why I think the way I've presented it is important. I don't want it to be hippie, like lazy hippie, new agey, warm and fuzzy, let's change the world and save the planet and everyone remove their lawns. Like, I hate that. It's not that. It's like, hey, what if we did this? Or you could do that. I don't care, but you have a choice, And suddenly when you see someone do that, it's like, oh, right, like this whole construction that I've inherited that I bought into, it's something we've inherited from another generation that doesn't make sense anymore. And it's up to all of us individually every day to question it and to say, this doesn't work, that doesn't work, I'm not doing this, I'm not doing that, I'm not participating in this, I'm doing this instead. And it doesn't mean I'm not wanting my lawn to give up. It means replacing something that was supposedly efficient and a pleasure that actually is wasteful and polluting and toxic and isolating, and replacing it with something actually that's more fun and more productive and healthier. So I'm approaching all of my projects purely from a place of pleasure, because these things all give me deep pleasure. And when I think about what do I want to do every day, what do I want to think about, it's like making gardens and dealing with animals. Like, that's what gives me pleasure, that's what I want to do, that's why I'm doing this. I'm not doing it because I feel some sort of duty to save the world or to solve a problem. I'm just tapping into what I feel like is appropriate moment for a conversation with something that I find pleasurable. And I think pleasure is something that we don't take seriously enough. And I think it's something that we don't understand anymore, because what is being presented to us as pleasure, what is being marketed to us as pleasure, isn't pleasure at all. It's a device for getting us to spend money and feel anxious and feel unworthy or, because it can never be sated. It's all about, aspirational things are predicated on the idea that they can never be sated, because if they are, you'll stop shopping and buying. Real pleasure gives a feeling of being sated, a feeling like, you've arrived at something and are having a physical experience. I'm totally rambling, but I think the point is with these families is I think it depends. Who knows? I think the families that I'm working with, they're willing to surrender to this whole crazy thing, which, frankly, the hardest part is, which I didn't realize till the very beginning, was the press, because the second garden already got picked up by the New York Times. Now every time I do a garden, it's like the local Fox News channel is there taking video for the evening news. It's like family removes lawn and plants food. Like details at 10, it's like news, you know? So for me, I'm not innately interested in that press. I'm interested in the fact that it's news. Like, what does it say about our society that it is worthy of national, global news for people to grow their own food? What does it mean for someone to say that what I'm doing is radical or new or, like, how ridiculous? Like, growing, you know, it's like the most basic human thing, growing your food where you live. It's like, how is that radical or new or novel? And that's the whole point I'm making. It's supposed to be my ideal moment when you have the project in your head is that it's simultaneously ridiculous and tragic and hopeful and utopian and funny and pleasurable, but all at once, kind of simultaneously, because you realize, like, oh yeah, everyone could do this tomorrow and the whole planet would change, but no one's gonna do this tomorrow. But maybe they will, but maybe they won't. And that's the moment you have to have in your head, because that's the moment we're living with right now. It's like, we don't know, and it's not like I have the answer and we're gonna solve it. And it's not like we don't have the answers, because we do. It's like, how are we all going to collectively be in a conversation about it? And I think we need to tap into that ambivalence. Because if we don't recognize, we can have happy, this really tired environmental verbiage that's all like warm and fuzzy and saving the planet. But we can't also have, like, we're all screwed and we need to continue what we're doing because it's the only efficient thing to do and nothing else works and everything else is a mess. There's something in the middle, and that's what I'm interested in. And it's why, you know, the screenwriter David Hare had this wonderful quote that I have to admit I heard in a Jane Fonda interview. But he said, the best place to be radical is in the middle. And I'm really interested in that as a way of operating, of penetrating exactly into the middle of culture, into the middle of the country, into the middle of disciplines, and starting there, you know, in a way. I don't know, do we have time for another question or two? And that, see, that's, okay, so she was saying how these edible forest gardens, and that's a perfect example of returning to the local, and this idea of the local, because what is an edible garden? It could be anything. It could be a fruit orchard of citrus in LA. It could be a forest garden in the Pacific Northwest. It could be, you know, berry bushes. It could be an herb garden in France. It could be, you know, it could be any number of things. And I get really excited about this big general idea that then becomes hyper-localized when it arrives someplace. And I mean, that's an example of something that I could never show up and do a garden like that. I would have no idea how I'd do that. So it's really exciting to hear about people self-organizing where you are doing that. Right. Well, when the garden's planted, we have a long weekend, we plant it, then I leave. Right. And I want to be as little involved as possible because I want to make it clear that they're not taking care of my garden. It's their garden. There's a weekly photographer that comes. I get updates, I get stories, but I try to stay out of their face. And it's theirs, it's not mine. So I care what happens. But whatever happens is... Whatever happens in these projects, it's hard to judge the success and failure of them because to me, they reveal something about who we are and how we're living today. Let's say one of the families can't do it. They give up and they remove it and plant a lawn. That might be a colossal failure if I was a nonprofit organization getting grants to do this, or if I was a gardener. But as with my interests, I'm interested in using these as prototypes that will reveal a reality of what we're confronting today. So I don't know. I mean, all the gardens are existing. They're all continuing. I mean, I go to great lengths to find families that are really serious, that know how to garden, that are, you know, going to continue it. The only unfortunate one is New Jersey. They sold the house the following year, which was interesting. I never got the scoop on, you know, whether it actually raised or lowered the property values. You know, it had been published everywhere. I mean, there were pictures of it everywhere. But I did get an email from the new homeowner saying, like, help, what should I do? We bought the house with your garden. And I'm not prepared to be that person, you know, because it's not my job to tell someone, like, okay, here's how you garden, here's how you grow food. It's like, I'm working with people who know more than me about that place, or, you know, I'm not coming to it from that place. So, you know, I directed her as I could and wished her the best. And I did come across her blog where she did send a picture of all the raised beds looking amazing, but she replaced the mulch area where there was seeding with lawn. So the lawn was creeping back into that garden. But, you know, one project I do want to do in a few years is a documentary where I travel to all the gardens and find out what happened to them and meet with the families. And I'm continuing. I mean, indefinitely, as good opportunities come up, I want to do one or two gardens a year. So in St. Louis, there'll be a really big, a couple of gardens there with the Museum of the Botanic Gardens in 2011, and maybe this year in Chicago, I'm not sure. But I don't know if that really answers your question, but really it's out of my hands. I mean, it's theirs, it's not mine, and my job is just to watch and find out.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Thank you.